From the Wings Archive.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. This special edition of Wings comes to you from TUC Radio in San Francisco. My name is Mariah Gillardin. In early October of 1993, I had the great pleasure of recording a talk by the Egyptian feminist, novelist, and medical doctor Noel El Saadawi. She spoke on the meaning of women's liberation in Arab society to a standing-room-only audience in San Francisco's Mission District. Dr. Saadawi lives in virtual exile in the U.S. and teaches women's studies at Duke and the University of Washington. She was imprisoned in Egypt for her writing and political work. Among the many books she wrote are God Dies by the Nile, Memoirs from the Women's Prison, and Woman at Point Zero. Dr. Saadawi is introduced by Nadine Neighbor.
Your struggles towards the liberation of Arab women has left you with many hardships and serious challenges to face, which many Arab women are not prepared to face. How is it possible for an Arab woman to truly work for liberation and freedom and to continue to play her role as a respectable woman in Arab society? What does liberation mean for the Arab woman?
That's a very, very big question. And in fact, it covers the whole topic. So, so I will try to divide it. First of all, she said, how can a woman in the Arab world work to liberate herself and the others and still be respected? This is a big, big problem. Why? Because respect and freedom does not go always together, especially in relation to women. Of course, I want to be a respected woman. I don't want to be despised. I don't want to be dismissed out of my work. I don't want to go to jail. I don't want to be shot by anybody. I want to live and work and be free and be respected. But I cannot do that. I cannot have all that. I have to pay a price. If I'm really going to be a free woman, a really liberated woman, in a free country, and I try to change the system, then I have to pay the price. And some women, some people, some men try to choose to pay the price and be free rather than pay the price and be oppressed. Because as oppressed women or as oppressed men, we have to pay a price. Oppression is very, very heavy, especially psychologically, socially, politically. When you are oppressed, you pay a very high price from your life, from your private life, from your public life. And it's a price. But a lot of people are afraid, so they prefer to be oppressed rather than be free. If you want to be free, then you have to pay a price too. You may lose your job, you may go to prison, you may threaten your life. It's a price. So what do we choose? We choose to pay a price and be free, or to pay a price and be oppressed and slaves? Well, I said I want to pay, I'll pay the price and be free. And here I am. I think I did it. I lost a lot. I lost my work, I lost my reputation. Now we are going to speak about respectability, the so-called to be respected or to be successful. I was a medical doctor. I wanted to be successful, to be respected. And my family, they sent me to college. And my father paid a lot, you know, for me to be a medical doctor. And then suddenly I have to lose my job, to be a failure, and to lose my reputation as a woman fighting for my liberation, etc. So how can you deal with such a conflict? How can you do that? How can you be a respectable woman and still be free and do what you want and write what you want and speak what you want and live and be respectable in the society? My question to you is there something specific in the Arab world that is different from here in America in relation to women? Because usually everywhere I go, they ask me, What about what's the true meaning of liberation of women in the Arab world? Is there any specific in the Arab region that is different from here? Is it religion? Is it Islam that really oppress women? Is it the Arab character, the Arab mind, the Arab personality? That is it the backwardness? Is it culture? Is it heritage? Is it history? What's in the Arab world that is specific in relation to oppression of women? Because here in the United States, in Europe, in the so-called Western societies, women are also oppressed. Women pay a very high price to be free too. So what's the difference between the oppression of women in our region and the oppression of women here? Do we have a common enemy? And who's that common enemy? Who? We have to look for. Because if we misdiagnose the enemy and we choose a false enemy, then we'll have a false battle. But if we make a correct diagnosis, then we can know the enemy. So do we have a common enemy, and who's that enemy? Is he the man? Religion? The political system? Capitalism? Imperialism? Class? Gender? History? Is it biology? Is it our biology? Our femininity? What's that? You know, we have to discuss that. Let's have a look at the Arab world. What do we mean by the Arab world? Because in the Arab world, we have Saudi Arabia, we have Egypt, we have Morocco, we have Sudan. So can we speak about Saudi Arabian women, for instance, status and position, the same as Egypt or Syria? Because it's very, very difficult to speak about the Arab world in general like that. Saudi Arabia, for instance, is totally different. Women in Saudi Arabia do not have the right to drive cars up till now. And maybe you remember during the Gulf War when some women in Saudi Arabia tried to drive their cars because their husbands were occupied with the war. And they wanted to drive their children to school. And they saw the American women, the soldiers who were sent there to protect. American women soldiers were sent to Saudi Arabia to protect Saudi Arabian men from and you see the paradox. Whenever you have exploitation, you must have paradoxes. You cannot have exploitation without paradoxes, without contradictions. Contradictions is the basis of exploitation. But the so-called patriarchal class system has to hide these paradoxes and these contradictions so that everything looks all right. But Saudi Arabia is a country that you see paradoxes there. And it shows really the contradiction of the class patriarchal system dominated by foreign colonialism in Saudi Arabia. You see that. And you see the link between international colonialism and family oppression and sexual oppression. And you see the link that you cannot separate between international politics and the bedroom, the oppression of women in the bedroom. You see it in Saudi Arabia. So what happened in Saudi Arabia? Saudi Arabia regime is supported by the United States government. If Saudi Arabia regime is not supported by U.S. government, they will fall in one day. They cannot survive. And the problem of the Arab world, the problem of Arab women, is not Islam. It's not because we are Arab. It's not because we belong to the East. It is because our local governments are allies to the international capitalist imperialist system. So let's come to Saudi Arabia again. So during the Gulf War, and you know the Gulf War, why the Gulf War happened. The Gulf War happened, was planned 2 years before the invasion of Kuwait. And you know the oil interest, how the United States and many of the European countries they have interest in the oil, and the problem of the Arab world, the problem of women in the Arab world, men and women, is that the oil. And the oil, instead of the oil being a weapon for us, instead of the oil being a resource of richness and the real development to the Arab people, to Arab men and women, it became as if it is a weapon against us. It was used against us because we were colonized and we are still colonized because of the oil. Exactly like Egypt, the cotton. Egypt is a very fertile valley, the Nile Valley. And because of that, we were colonized by the British. And we had to produce cotton for Manchester and for the British. So sometimes your richness become against you in a colonial system. And that's how the Arab world was colonized, because of the oil. So what happened that before the Gulf War, before the invasion of Kuwait, 2 years before the invasion of Kuwait, the United States was planning this war, and it happened. During the war, the men in Saudi Arabia, they went into the war. So women were left alone. Saudi Arabian women, who were, some of them were professors in the university, and they had to drive their children to school because the men are not there, and they were not allowed. So what did they do? They started a demonstration, 50 women. They said, okay, we'll take our cars and put our children and drive to school. And they went as 50 women in cars, so they took them to the police. Some of them, many of them were fired. Even their husbands were threatened. And the leaders, the religious leaders, they made statements against those women. And they said that they are morally corrupt and that they violated Islam. And I wrote an article in our magazine called Noon, the magazine of the Arab Women Solidarity Association. And I said, how can Islam be against driving cars? First of all, first of all, there were no cars during Islam at the beginning. There were no cars. The Quran did not mention any car. That's number one. Number two is that during Islam, during Prophet Muhammad, women drove camels and horses in battles. So what's the difference between driving a camel and driving a car? What's the difference? And they said, at least the car has a ceiling, so it protects a woman. But if you drive an animal, you are not protected, you know? So in a way, if Islam and Prophet Muhammad during the war, women were fighting with Prophet Muhammad and riding animals and fighting with him, and this was allowed. So how can I imagine that Islam is against driving cars? So that's the interpretation of Saudi Arabia to Islam. You see how ridiculous this interpretation, how they distort Islam. And they say that people like me are distorting Islam. They are the people who are really distorting Islam. Because if people here in the West hear about women in Saudi Arabia are not allowed to drive cars, are not allowed to work, and etc., they will say, what's such a religion? What's such a stupid religion that women cannot drive cars? So in a way, they are the people who distort Islam. It's not we. I think I give a very positive image of Islam and Muslim women as women. I think so. Because at least I am saying that Muslim women have brains, they can talk, they can speak up, they are human beings, and this is a very good image of Islam. So in a way, the paradoxes in Saudi Arabia is that you have a society that's so rich in resources, so rich in oil, in money. One of the Kuwaiti rulers, he gave $2 million as a fund to the zoo, And children are dying and starving in the Arab world. You see the paradoxes, how the most of their money are invested in the West, and most of their money here in the West, not in our region, developing the region. And then they speak about religion, about Islam, about chastity, about morality, and this is a lot of hypocrisy. And they are supported, they are kept in their position, on their thrones, by the US government and by US policy, and before that by the British. So, in a way, we have to know that the liberation of women is not just fighting against men. Of course, part of it is fighting against the man who oppresses me in the home. If there is a man, if there is a husband that's oppressing me in the home, I have to fight. I have to fight and get my liberation. Because if I am not free as an individual, I cannot free others. We have a proverb in Arabic saying, فَاقِدْ الشَّيْءِ لَا يُعْطِي. فَاقِدْ الشَّيْءِ. If I'm not free, how can I speak about freedom? I came here to speak because I already made my battle in my home. And I had to fight in my home and to be free. And in order to fight to liberate my country, I have to be free also. So in a way, we must have this individual struggle and collective struggle together. And we cannot separate at all between liberation of women and liberation of our country, of our land, of our economy. It is inseparable, inseparable. And we have to fight on all these fronts. We cannot separate between sexual oppression in the bedroom and the international economic order and colonialism. It's all linked. And we can see that in our life. When I go to my village, I see what's happening there. How in Egypt we are now producing what we do not eat and eat what we do not produce. And that's why we become poor. Instead of producing our wheat, to feed our children, we are importing wheat from the United States, and we pay for it. And I read a study, which is very important, that say that it is Egypt that gives money to the United States. It's not the opposite, that we receive aid. It's not the opposite. Money from the so-called third world, from Egypt, from Somalia, from the Arab world, from India, from Africa, from Latin America, the so-called third world, the money and the flow of richness go from the third world to the first. It's not the opposite. And then they send us just a very, very small fraction of what we pay under the name of aid. So they humiliate us and say, we are giving you aid. It's not aid, it's part of our money that we paid. And we pay interest for this aid. And that's why we are drowned in debts. The problem of Egypt now, and Somalia, and many countries in Latin America, in Africa, and Asia, is the foreign debt. And the interest of the debt is now more than the debt itself. Because of this vicious circle that we produce what we do not eat and eat what we do not produce. And this affects women. Because women are more than half the society. And whenever we have poverty, women are affected first. So we have this phenomena of feminization of poverty. And women are poor and becoming more and more poor. The gap between the rich and the poor is increases in our countries. And the gap between the United States and our people is increasing. I'm here in Duke. And I am seeing how professors in universities live here and how people live here. It's, you cannot compare your life here and your salaries and your comfort with the people in Egypt or in my region. We work, people work hard and are paid nothing so that people here can consume and can reach comfortably. That's the colonialism. That's the new world order. Or the old new world, it's the same old. It is very, very dangerous for many professors to speak about women and Islam separate from politics and especially international politics. And now, especially now, I am seeing the TV and the media here and the image of Islam, how Islam now became the enemy. The new enemy after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I'm really amazed how they create enemies. During the Gulf War, how they made Saddam Hussein a Hitler, another Hitler. It's the media. And the media is becoming very, very dangerous. And it brainwashes the people all the time. Professors in universities are not knowing what's happening around the world. People who teach political sciences, political science, and political economy in universities don't know about this vicious circle, how people are made poor. So what we do? I think we need international solidarity between women and international solidarity between progressive groups. People here, I met a lot of American people here who speak the same language. I read books by some professors here, very good. They analyze the Gulf War. They are speaking about this poverty created artificially by colonialism. So these are the people of the future who are going to fight together to liberate men and women from this system. Because we are living in one world. We are not living in three worlds, first, second, third, no. Now we are living in one world. We are governed by a superpower, one superpower. It's a military, capitalist, imperialist machine based on power, military power, and class, and they oppress the poor, and they oppress women. And that's it. That's the world we are living in. And we have to fight this system. And we are the majority. We are the majority. We have power, but we are not using it. We are not organized. We are divided. We are fragmented. But it's time now that we should really come together, cross the boundaries of nations, of gender, of color, of class, and come together and fight. So long we understand now how politics is working. And this is the only way to liberate women. Because it's very difficult now to liberate women alone. It's very difficult now for one country to liberate herself alone. It would be very, very small and powerless in front of this giant, this military industrial capitalist machine. So unless another power comes, and unless another new power comes of the people who really are fed up with this system, the poor, the black, women, progressive people in the West, people in Asia and Africa, come together and understand and work together. And that's why I'm here. That's why I come here and talk. Because this is the only hope to get out of this big power. I would like to finish about the fundamentalist movement. We speak about fundamentalist movement here. A lot of people think it's an Islamic movement. And it's not. It has nothing to do with Islam or Christianity or Judaism. It's a universal phenomenon. And it's related to politics and to colonialism and capitalism and imperialism. The fundamentalist movement is the son of colonialism and capitalism. And it's not specific to the Arab world or to Islam. There is Christian fundamentalism here, very strong Christian fundamentalist movement here in the West and in Europe. There is Jewish fundamentalist, very strong Jewish fundamentalist movement in Israel. There is a Hindu fundamentalist movement in India. Everywhere now, there is revival of religion. Because we are living in this system, and this international, imperialist, colonial system cannot live without support from religion. They need religion. They use God to justify injustices. They use God to keep the status quo. And that's why we have this revival of religions all over. I'll give you a concrete example, two examples. In Egypt, it was Sadat who encouraged both the Islamic and the Christian fundamentalism for two reasons. To divide the country by religion and to diminish the political power of other groups like the Nasser groups, the socialist groups, and the communist groups. Then, after he encouraged them, then they started to have power, and then they killed him. So the son killed the father. And this is a story in history that's repeated in history. In the United States, is a capitalist, imperialist country. And they were their traditional enemy, as you know, was the Soviet Union and communism. So they had to fight the Soviet Union and communism. So how can they fight it? They have to fight it with religion. A lot of young people from Egypt, from Pakistan, from Afghanistan, from Saudi Arabia were recruited in Afghanistan under the banner of Islam or religion to fight against the Soviet Union and against communism. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union and communism, what to do with these people, with those groups, with those young people? What to do with them? And now those groups, thousands of those young people, are becoming a threat. And they are the core of the fundamentalist movement in Egypt, in Pakistan, in Saudi Arabia, and in Afghanistan. Those who were fighting the Soviet Union, now they are idle. They have no work. And also I have to say that the fundamentalist movement attracts a lot of young people in our region. Why? Because the local governments failed to provide the basic needs to the young people. If you go to Algeria or Egypt or Sudan or Jordan or Syria or anywhere, you find thousands of people who graduate from universities with no job, nothing, no hope. So they join the fundamentalists. And they think it is a protest movement. It's really, part of it is a protest movement against the local governments and against Western intervention and against American imperialism, etc. But they don't know, because they are used by the leaders under the name of religion. And religion is very attractive to the poor, because Prophet Muhammad at the beginning, he was fighting for the poor and women at the beginning. So a lot of women and poor people, they join the fundamentalists. Because of their hope, they think that religion will realize their dreams, and they are used. So here we are in this situation. Whenever you have revival of religion, you have oppression of women. It's not revival of all parts of religion. It's revival of the most reactionary parts of religion. There are people who are Christian and Muslims, and they believe in justice, because religion is justice. My grandmother, who was illiterate and peasant, she understood Islam better than professors of Islam in many universities, because she said something. God is justice, and we knew him by him or her, by our mind. So that's the philosophy of my grandmother, and that's religion. And as I said yesterday, I'll finish, that religion is freedom, justice, and love. Religion is not a book. God does not come out of a printing machine. This is why. Why I'm saying that? Why I'm saying God does not come out of a printing machine? That God is not a text on a paper written by ink. Because they use this book politically. They make religion a political ideology, and they fight us with this book, with the paper, with the ink. But religion is far, real religion is justice and freedom and love. So I think I am much more religious than people who speak about the text. And thank you very much.
Exiled Egyptian psychiatrist and novelist Dr. Nawal El-Sadawi spoke in San Francisco in 1993. Wings thanks Mariah Gilardin of TUC Radio, your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.